To the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. For those who had Seder last weekend, I hope it was a lovely and meaningful event. For those who are having Easter celebrations this weekend, I hope the same. And for all of us, I hope this is the last year that we do it by Zoom. Before we go to our guest, Simone Ledeen, here is your JPC commercial. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. You can find us on the website at jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our insight articles and our magazine, In Focus. The spring issue of In Focus was just posted this week. It considers priorities for Congress and the administration, and there are a lot of them, and we hope you'll look at it. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel relations, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. In this series of calls, and I'm happy to say we're going into our second year now, we have been very pleased to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues including China in various permutations, Israeli sovereignty in Judea and Samaria, and Israel's relations with China, the Abraham Accords, Iran sanctions, and little side trips to the American defense budget and the Supreme Court. Now your public service announcement. You are muted. I think you knew that. But you can ask questions using the Q&A function on your Zoom screen. We are monitoring the Q&A and the chat during the program. So questions, put them on the Q&A function. I am really pleased to have Simone Ledeen with us today, partly because I've known her for a long time and I know she's full of great information. We're all going to learn something today. She was until January, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East, responsible for DoD policy across a vast and vital area stretching from the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, that's Egypt, Israel, Syria, and Lebanon, across Jordan and Iraq, down through the Gulf states, and to Iran. If that's not big enough for you, I don't know what is. Prior to that, she served as Principal Director to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. There, she provided oversight of the employment of special operating forces in counterterrorism, military support operations, unconventional and irregular warfare, direct action, special reconnaissance, foreign internal defense, counterproliferation, sensitive special operations personnel recovery, and hostage issues at the specification of the Secretary of Defense. I know that's going to open a whole new avenue for questions on your Zoom screen. For over a decade, Simone has spent time in and out of the government. Her first government assignment was in 2003, as advisor to the Iraqi Ministry of Finance in Baghdad, where she served as part of the Coalition Provisional Authority. In 2009 and 10, she was the senior US Treasury representative to NATO's International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. She has a civilian life. In her civilian life, she served as an executive director at Standard Chartered Bank, where she led the successful launch of the bank's multinational finance and crime compliance program in Africa, the Middle East, and Pakistan. So get your fingers ready. Simone Ledeen, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Shoshana. It's great to be here with you today and with everybody who has dialed in. Thank you all very much. In our little sort of prelude to this session today, and I look forward to answering all of your questions. I know, Shoshana, you have some prepared, and hopefully those of you in the audience have additional questions. I'd like to open today by talking a bit about the Abraham Accords and sort of the aftermath of the Abraham Accords, although they're not really over. They're actually, you know, continuing to gained speed, and I think we are only starting to learn what the second and third order effects of these accords will be. So I'd like to back up a little bit. and talk about what led us to being able to have the Abraham Accords, because I think that they caught a lot of people by surprise. So as Shoshana mentioned, I began, the last time I left government was in 2014 after having served for nearly 12 years in various capacities. And I moved to UAE to work for a British bank that was in trouble for violating the US-Iran sanctions. And during that time, was very interesting. Obviously, as a person myself, an American Jewish person, was very interesting to be there. At the time, obviously, there was a small community of expatriates who would get together quietly in a nondescript location with no signage or whatever. You had to get on a WhatsApp list to know where the services were, et cetera. What I found was interesting as I lived there for several years was that my Emirati counterparts, friends, colleagues at the bank were all very welcoming. And I did not feel any sort of apprehension about being there. Now, by then I had lived in several other countries that were dominated by Muslim religion. But this was a very welcoming place for me, a very open place for me. And you could feel that, and actually one of my Emirati friends told me, we're cousins. And I thought that was very interesting. However, I must say, fast forward to December, when I was in the Dubai airport and the primary language that I heard was Hebrew. I never could have imagined that, and especially in such a short period of time. So I hope that we get a chance to talk about that today a bit more. I think that the conditions for bringing that about were already there. And I would say even I didn't realize how quickly this could have happened once the agreement was made. So I think that first and foremost, the state of Israel has made, we can all agree, just remarkable progress in a very short time for such a young country, and is really dominating so many sectors in the region now. And frankly, the success has been noted. And a lot of the regional partners looked at Israel not as a threat, but asking themselves, how can we get in on this? We also would like to benefit from Israel's knowledge, Israel's expertise, the advancements that they've made in a number of critical areas, water being one. I know water desalinization is a huge challenge across the Gulf, and looking at what Israel has done has been very compelling for them. They want access to that technology. So there are a number of things really in the non-defense, non-military space that I think encourage this partnership to come together. I think also there's been over the past several decades an awareness that the question of, there are many different ways to phrase this, but I will just call it the Israeli-Palestinian challenge is not, the resolution of that does not really lie with the Israelis. And I think there was an understanding of that among regional leadership. And so once that determination was made, I think there's a broader desire to bring the Palestinian Authority, the leadership of the Palestinian people to the table in some way. Really to create a partnership and work together and kind of stop fighting reality. There is a Jewish state of Israel. There will continue to be a Jewish state of Israel. And, you may as well get on board. And I think that some of these other partners were sort of tired of the same excuse being put forward and really nothing ever changing, whereas the world was changing. And when you look at the threat to these countries from Iran, it was growing. And There was also a clear understanding that some American administrations are willing to do what we need to do in order to counter Iran, and some have a different view. And I think we're seeing that play out right now. So I think also these countries understood they needed they wanted a robust partnership and relationship with the state of Israel, who had been working to counter Iran for many years now. And so I think among the different pillars of the Abraham Accords partnerships, I think the most sort of ginger, you know, delicate discussions are happening in the security arena, because these are new relationships, although there have been longstanding, quiet, intelligence sharing relationships among a lot of these countries. The more sort of open, sharing of broader and bigger and more sensitive military systems will take a little bit longer. But I will also add, some of these countries who have normalized relations with Israel are now facing an increased threat from Iran. And so it's even more important for them to broaden partnerships, broaden relationships, and work together, hopefully to address this common challenge and common enemy. Hopefully today we'll also talk a bit about Egypt. I recently wrote an article that got a bit of attention about the importance of maintaining the U.S. maintaining its relationship with Israel, with Egypt, also with Israel, obviously. But in terms of Egypt, there's been a big focus from the Biden administration early on the human rights record of President al-Sisi and his government. I think we can all agree that there is certainly work to do. And my point was not to diminish that. But what I did want to point out was the U.S.-Egypt relationship is absolutely critical. It's something that we've invested in for decades. I think the size of the Israeli army reflects the fact that the U.S. is in the Sinai working with the Egyptians. They're facing threats. The Egyptians are facing threats on all sides. And they are challenged right now because there are some roadblocks ahead for them. So my whole point was, there is work to do. We should be working together. But cutting off all aid, for example, cutting off our foreign military financing relationship is not the way, in my view. And so I'm looking forward to diving into that a bit more as well. So Shoshana, hopefully that was helpful and a good opener for us. And I look forward to the conversation today.
Thank you, Simone. It gives us a start. And so we have a question from a listener. And I think this question goes two ways. I think it's also a question about you, but also a question about the Gulf states. He asks, are women being treated with more equal rights in the Abraham Accord countries? And how did you see that as a female employee of the Department of Defense?
Well, first of all, I was very proud to be named as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East as a female. Just, you know, what do we call it today? Gender identity. My gender identity aside, or my gender aside, you know, I was very proud to get the job, but also the fact that I was a woman also made me happy that the U.S. was choosing female representation. So are women being treated with more equal rights? I mean, I can speak to like Bahrain and I've never actually been to Morocco, so I don't know, but I've been to Bahrain many times. I've been to UAE, obviously. And I think, well, both countries are quite different, but I think you would maybe be surprised. I think the Saudis, although they have not normalized yet with Israel, we can talk about that later if you'd like, They, I think they, you know, they have some work to do. I think there is still absolutely work to do. We're not at, you know, equality, but women in a lot of these Gulf states, some of you may be surprised if you've never visited them, women drive, women work, women own businesses. So there are still things that could be improved. And I'm not saying the laws there are similar to laws here, but you would be surprised at the level of equality that women do enjoy in the countries. Sudan, I've never been to Sudan. I can't speak to that. But in the Gulf, certainly, progress is being made and quite quickly. The younger generation with access to the internet, with access to a lot of kind of global influences, have really changed the way that they operate. And so, for example, in a lot of these countries, you know, head coverings are not required unless you're going into a mosque. It's much more modern than I think we're historically used to.
It's moving. I would also point out that a large percentage of the scientific component of the Bahrain Mars mission was female. And these were Bahrainis. Yes. These were not like French people who came to Bahrain to run the mission for them. These were people born and raised in Bahrain, and a large percentage were female. I also saw a female soccer referee in Dubai at a major soccer event. She was wearing shorts and a short sleeve shirt. And I have to say, I was surprised. Okay,
so and that doesn't surprise me, actually. You may be surprised to know that hearing that doesn't surprise me. You know, there are women that are at the head of the Mars mission on the UAE side. There are women who are really driving the country in many respects, and it's very exciting to see. And I'm excited about where they're headed next. I think it's really remarkable.
So we have things to learn. We here have things to learn about how they do things there. So you mentioned two other countries. You mentioned Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And I know that there are people who believe Saudi Arabia will be next in line to go public. I'm interested in your thoughts. But also Qatar, which is, in my opinion, playing both sides of the fence. It is the spokesperson and the money carrier for Iran in many ways. But it also works with Israel and works with others. How do you see them formalizing, if at all, their relations with Israel?
Well, I really hope that they do. I think it would be obviously to the benefit of His Highness and to really to the benefit of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the people of Saudi Arabia. So I hope that they do. I think it's obvious that there is a greater level of cooperation than has ever existed between the two countries, although it remains quiet. However, I think they view it in a different light than a lot of these other countries because of Mecca and Medina and the responsibility that they have towards Islam that they feel obviously very, very deeply about. So this is something that I hope they're working on. And we did our best during our tenure to really encourage the normalization of Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, we didn't quite get there with them, but I think it's inevitable, ultimately. I don't know how long it will take before there is an agreement, but I do believe that it is inevitable and it will happen.
Question from a listener. Speaking of human rights in Saudi Arabia, what do you think the impact was of the release of the report on the death of Khashoggi and the very public slap that was taken at Saudi Arabia?
Well, thanks for the question. I have pretty strong views about that. First of all, as a former intelligence analyst, I don't think that anything new was released in that report. I think that it was unnecessary and unfortunate. I think clearly there was some wrongdoing there. Dealing with someone in the way that Khashoggi, was unfortunately murdered. I mean, that is not the way to handle anything. That was murder. But we didn't learn anything new from the report. And really, for a new administration to come in and sort of that's the base, they've really declared that's the baseline of our relationship with Saudi Arabia. So that's a negative place to start, especially when there's so many other things on the table. Now, obviously, I have a very defense-centric view, but when you're looking towards the challenges that the United States is facing right now, particularly from the East, from China, and this very strong desire and necessity that we have to move a lot of our capabilities east, our partnerships are strong partnerships, and the strength of our partnerships become even more important because we are going to be expecting them to pick up some of the slack if we do shift east. So to sort of slap them for that right off the bat, especially when you're not really saying anything that hasn't been said already, was puzzling and frankly disappointing to me. And I think it started things off poorly. And I'm also decreased the leverage that the United States could have had with Saudi Arabia to, for example, encourage normalization with Israel, encourage them to disrupt some of their partnership activities with countries like China that are deleterious to the United States and our position as the partner of choice on the defense and military side. So there are a lot of, I think, ill-considered second and third order effects that we will see from that. And it was very disappointing from my perspective.
I would agree. You said another major keyword, and that's China. It used to be that we pretty much thought we had the region to ourselves. We could do good things or bad things or smart things or not smart things. But whatever happened, we were kind of doing it by ourselves. China suddenly has made an appearance in the region and with Iran. So we have questions. China and Iran, China and Israel, China and Egypt. What are the Chinese doing? How much of a problem do you think that is for us? And where are they going to end up?
Well, I feel like I'm about to step on a soapbox. This is a big problem for us. This is a huge, huge problem for us. So we thankfully are no longer reliant on Middle East energy, Middle East oil. However, China is. China cannot function without oil from the Middle East. And when you are a military commander looking at how you may, in the event of a conflict, what are the choke points? That's a big one. So handing over these relationships to China is problematic to us from this perspective, number one. Number two, China does not engage in normal economic relations with other countries. I think there have been many really good articles about China sort of feeding off of other countries' economies, signing deals that basically make them beholden to them. So I think that's what, obviously I haven't seen the agreement signed between China and Iran, but I'm certain Iran's economy is in the worst place that it's ever been, thanks to the maximum pressure campaign, and unfortunately for them, the COVID outbreak in Iran, and the continuing effects from that, and damage across the country. So really, my belief and the belief of many of my former colleagues is that Iran has really signed itself away to China. because they had no other choice. And also the regime, and really it's unfortunate because when I say Iran, I should say the Iranian regime. Obviously we all support the Iranian people and their desire to be free from this despotic regime. So I think now they've signed themselves away. There've been, if you've seen, there've been actually demonstrations inside of Iran against this deal because the people understand what's happened. And the regime officials will continue to enrich themselves off of these types of deals at the expense of the Iranian people and any potential future that they could have had. So it does give China access to energy resources, which is what they want. And they're like a bottomless pit when it comes to desire for energy resources, but at the expense of the Iranian people. So I hope that, you know, as you mentioned, Shoshana, some of what I used to work on at the Pentagon was military information support operations, like, you know, IO kind of things, information operations. I hope that we are messaging and our allies and partners are also messaging to the Iranian people directly how bad this is for them. So China's making moves there. They've made this big move with Iran. I would also like to add, it's notable that this deal was signed during the Biden administration and not the Trump administration. I think there are specific reasons for that. We knew this might happen when I was in my old job. We knew this might happen, but it didn't. And they waited until Biden was in office, which is notable. I also think China has stolen a lot of our intellectual property over the years, particularly, well, in many different areas, but also in artificial intelligence. And they've also copied a lot of our military technology, our hardware, some of our fighter jets, for example. Unfortunately, they've copied to some extent. They are trying to sell them to our partners. For those of you who aren't aware, the process for buying US military hardware is difficult and it takes a long time. We have a lot of requirements and that's in order to protect our sensitive technology and it's expensive. So for some countries, it's easier to buy from a China, but they don't offer things like, you know, maintenance. They don't offer things like training. And they also like, it's basically one and done. So if you have, let's say you need maintenance work on your jets, we send people, we work with them on that. China wouldn't do that. And also they have a lot, all of these partners have US weaponry that's not interoperable with things that China would produce and sell to them. But it's becoming more and more desirable also because these weapons deals are not just weapons deals. They're an agreement for long-term partnerships because the purchasing country will use them for many years, will require, you know, new parts, new things. And that's a relationship. That's not just a one and done. So what China's doing and making these moves is very strategic. Again, they have a long view. They have their 100-year plan and they're executing it very successfully. So I think we cannot cede these relationships because once they're lost, I don't know how we get them back. We have spent so much blood and treasure in the region. We have provided so much training. We've built very deep, deep relationships with many of these countries. On the defense side, many of their military leaders have gone through US military academies. They've gone through training in the US. It would be, I think, catastrophic to our long-term security if we were to cede the relationships to China, given their clear and stated desire to overtake us globally and in the region.
And China doesn't have human rights requirements, and China doesn't have some of the other things that we add to the package. And so maybe that also makes China, in the short term, for some of these governments, they think it's a better bet because the Chinese won't harass them.
It's also very well said, Shoshan, and I think it's also incredibly important that we continue to raise the alarm about the mass murder of the Uyghur Muslims and the treatment of Uyghur Muslims, the concentration camps that have been stood up to put, you know, Uyghur Muslims in, the production of a number of cotton products in China is actually the result of this is slave labor by the Uyghur Muslims in these camps, as has been published recently. So I think, especially for countries in the Middle East that are Muslim and care about Islam and the treatment of Muslims worldwide, this is a very important message that we really need to keep really front and center in all of our discussions, as we're encouraging them not to partner with China and to keep their relationships with the United States.
I think that's a really important point. We write about the Uyghurs here fairly often. And most of the time, for most places, I don't like the use of words that have Holocaust analogies. But in this case, I think these really are concentration camps. There really is a genocide of Uyghur people. I mean, this really comes close to those things that we know
yes.
a lot about. Let's move slightly. You talked about how we've invested time and treasure and American soldier lives in a lot of these countries, and particularly in Iraq. And Iraq is in an awkward spot. It happens to live next to Iran. But Iran has taken over Iraq in certain kinds of ways, and some Iraqi people don't like that. Some Iraqi people would rather be independent. Some would like to be our friends. Talk to us, if you can, about the relationship right now between the United States and the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people. Not so much Iraq and Iran, but Iraq and us.
So, as you mentioned, I served in Iraq very early on, 2003 and 2004. One of my brothers also, both my brothers served in the Marine Corps. One did two tours in Western Iraq. Obviously, the relationship has changed dramatically since then, both in positive and negative ways. I think first and foremost, Prime Minister Khatami is the best partner that we've had since 2003, really. He wants to work with us, and he has been really focused on this anti-corruption effort. However, he's challenged because his life is in danger. he's under physical threat. So he has to do what he has to do in order to survive. So I think that we need to take sort of a clear-eyed view of that. I think our best bet for maintaining a long-term partnership with Iraq is to continue the relationships that we've built on the military side with the Iraqi army in particular. The challenge, however, is we can't ignore what happened when President Obama pulled out completely of Iraq, and that left a big gaping hole that was filled by Iranian influence. So a lot of things happened at that time. A lot of the military commanders in the Iraqi army that we'd been training and working with were removed and replaced by people that were supported by the Iran-backed Shia militias. And it's important, by the way, to call them Iran-backed Shia militias, because that's exactly what they are. And a lot of them, and Prime Minister Khatami has said this, they are like criminal gangs. They are criminal gangs, with one notable exception, which is they also receive salaries from the central government. That becomes even more notable when you look to the north, to the Kurds and the Kurdish military force, the Peshmerga, who were our very close partners in the fight against ISIS not too long ago. They are still challenged to receive stipends from the Iraqi central government, because the Iraqi central government is paying the Iran-backed Shia militias. So in an environment like that, what is the US position? Well, when you look to the Iraqi population, and I would take the demonstrations of several years ago as sort of a guidepost, they don't want any foreign interference. They want everyone out. They want their Iraqi nationalists, and they want self-determination, and they want all of us out. So I don't think it would be good for us to increase our presence there and try to go back to the old days where we were whispering in everyone's ear, you know, giving them money, telling them what to do. Those days are over now. And, you know, we can't go back. So, and this is, you know, someone who I've spent a lot of time there. I've lost friends, you know, we've been through a lot, but this, you know, going back in, boots on the ground, certainly not an option for us now. What we have to do is work to salvage the relationship that we have and maintain some sort of influence. And going back to my beginning statement about this, I think the way to do that is to maintain the relationships that we have in the defense and security sector, you know, the sharing that we do with them, and also, quite frankly, economic deals, you know, oil and gas. There are a lot of other countries that are working there now, and we should be there too. There's a lot of benefit to be gained. Of course, it is challenging because of the extreme corruption that exists in Iraq. And as someone who previously worked in banking compliance, I can tell you that there are a lot of US companies who want to work there, but are concerned about getting hit with, you know, sanctions and getting hit with other legal problems because of the depth of corruption in Iraq. You know, we are prohibited from paying bribes. And in order to get some contracts in Iraq, these officials require bribes. So that's just, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, Shoshana, but it's a very complex subject. And, but that's sort of how I view our relationship with Iraq and really where I think it should go next. We should not be taking huge steps.
I think it's important to think about civilian trade and industry that could be done. I mean, that's a very important point, and I think that's not really recognized very much in the United States. So moving from one corrupt place to another corrupt place, Lebanon. We also spend, the United States does a lot of time and effort with the Lebanese Armed Forces, the Army of Lebanon, military. And I think the idea was to present an alternative to Hezbollah and the terrorist forces that are supported by Iran that live in Lebanon. Who does the Lebanese Armed Forces work for? Can you talk about how they fit? We know there's been sharing between the Lebanese Armed Forces and Hezbollah, including of equipment that we have given to the LAF. Are they on our side? Are they not on our side? I don't know. Where are they?
Very, very good and controversial question. So there are a lot of people in the defense and security establishment in the US who are very complimentary of the LAF, of the Lebanese Armed Forces, and say, you know, because there's a history there of the leadership not being aligned with Hezbollah, being, you know, Lebanese of a Christian descent, Christian background, that they're different. My personal opinion, now that I'm not in government, I'll be a lot more honest about this. I think that's false. I think that there's a huge amount of, you know, Hezbollahi influence in the LAF. And yes, there are commanders who are with us, certainly. With us, meaning like with the West, not with Iran and Hezbollah. But there are some who still believe that, you know, in the event of a Lebanese civil war and a complete breakdown in Lebanon, which unfortunately looks increasingly likely, at least a complete economic collapse of the country is coming, in my opinion. I don't think there's anything anyone can do to stop it, quite frankly. I don't think that the LAF will somehow be the savior and come in and fix everything. And I would point to the aftermath of the port explosion as sort of exhibit A for why that's how I feel. The United States provided dozens of planes full of aid right afterwards, really medical aid, you know, some water, some MREs, some PPE for COVID. And we watched those pallets sit on the tarmac for days. Now, some of them, you know, the LAF came and got them, but a lot of them didn't go where they needed to go. I'll just leave it at that. And that's a smaller scale. We didn't really provide that much, in part because Secretary Esper, you know, had a very strong belief, and it played out that, you know, the Lebanese government hadn't provided any indication that we should be hopeful that they would use our aid in the way in which it was intended. So why would a broader scale problem, why would something on a broader scale work out? Why would there be a different end state there? I don't think we have any basis for hoping that it would be. So I'm very sorry, because I know now there are some specialized units within the Lebanese Armed Forces that work with our special operations professionals. Those relationships might be different, but I haven't seen any indication at all that they're willing to stand up against Hezbollah. In fact, they don't. So they're willing to do operations with us against ISIS, which is fine. But, you know, when you're looking at the entirety of the problem in Lebanon, ISIS isn't what's collapsing the economy and the government and the country itself. It's not ISIS.
So again, you have a country where the people are held hostage to a government that takes positions that that don't help the people. You have it in Iran, you have it in Iraq, you have it in Lebanon. In some ways, that's kind of the opposite of what we saw and what you talked about with the Abraham Accord countries, countries that decided they needed to do certain kinds of things for their own people. And you mentioned the result of this is the Palestinians, what should we say? They lost their status as the primary issue of the Middle East, or they lost their financial value, whatever. So the Palestinians, and I think I want to come back to this, maybe as kind of the last thing that we do, because we only have a couple of minutes. If the Palestinians are looking at a choice between being like the Emirates and Bahrain, or being like Lebanon, and Jordan has the same problem in many ways, where are they going to go? We are about to start giving financial aid to the Palestinians again, despite the Taylor Force Act. How do you figure out how to get the Palestinians to jump the right way? Is there something we can do?
Well, I think that you're tying together of these countries and their populations is something that I agree with. I think, you know, the Palestinian Authority, there's going to be another election this summer, I think, in July. We'll see. But there's a new generation of Palestinians who want something different. And they're running, I would call Fadi al-Salamin is one of them, who started this movement on Facebook like 10 years ago, starting to call out the corruption of the PA. And it's become this huge online movement. If you haven't visited his Facebook page, I would highly recommend it because people post on there all the time. They'll post pictures of, you know, a boss private jet, a boss palace. The Palestinian, I mean, I hope, and my belief is that they want part of this Abraham Accords pie. You know, a lot of them just want to, you know, live and have opportunities the way that opportunities are available in other countries. So instead of living under the thumb of these rulers who've really done nothing to help them in all of these years. So I know there certainly are many who remain radicalized and are angry and you know, want to be violent. And I'm certainly not, my intent is not at all to downplay that. But I think from a broader political perspective, these new young people and new political leaders, those have to be the future. And I certainly, you know, as long as it's helpful, would like to do what I can and see what we could do to support them without it turning into like a net negative for them having, you know, support from certain areas. But I think a lot of people have looked to the Abraham Accords, Shoshana, especially in the PA, and said, you're not even going to talk to them. You're not even going to see what we can get. Why wouldn't you do that? That has generated a lot of discontent, and I hope we'll see what happens this summer with the elections, but probably not very much, unfortunately, but maybe it started the ball rolling in a more positive direction. That's certainly my hope.
So two last points. We had someone ask us again, what is the name of the guy who's posting on Facebook? People want to write it down. People want to go there. So give us.
His name is Fadi Al-Salamin. He's also on Twitter. It's the last name Al-Salamin, one word. And actually he's in this past 2 weeks, I think he's been the subject of a public death threat from Fatah. And thankfully, because he's also a US citizen, the State Department has actually come out and condemned this. But he's, you know, he's active on his Facebook is really, I think, the most interesting because there are many, many people who'll just, they'll see something, they'll snap it. And these are Palestinians again, they'll snap it, post a picture on Facebook. And it's really become this self-generating movement where you can see that it's the corruption at the end of the day in a lot of these countries. It's really people are living hard lives, and they look around and they see how their leadership members of their leadership are living, and it's quite striking, and it angers them. And I think, you know, we may see real change you know, generate as a result. That's my hope.
So people who tune us in every once in a while know that I like to end a program by asking a question, the answer to which is a positive statement. So I think I'm not going to do it because you just gave us a positive statement. I think, in fact, that if there is real hope for positive change in the region, it is these young people who see the corruption, who don't want to be occupied. They don't want us either necessarily, but they don't want those people. And maybe the hope for change is A, the young people who want better, and B, the example that's set by the Abraham Accords. And I think that's actually a positive note on which to say thank you very much. This was a great program. I appreciate it. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in.
Thank you very much. Bye, everyone.